Welcome to the Readings Podcast, a production from Melbourne's leading independent bookstore, Readings. In today's episode, a conversation with author Sandra Goldblum-Zorbo, recorded live at the launch of her memoir, My Father's Shadow. Zorbo grew up enthralled to her father, a prominent anti-war activist, brilliant political organizer, and covert member of the Communist Party. She adopted his beliefs from an early age, becoming a supporter of the Soviet Union and a peace campaigner. She travelled with him, meeting figures such as Indonesian President Sukarno, and greeted Paul Robeson and North Korean delegates with him at home. But her father could be withholding and difficult. He had a sharp backhand, and was not always a faithful husband. When Sandra entered adulthood and began to navigate a patriarchal world of work and relationships, she came to question aspects of her father's worldview. As the communist ideals of the left were tested and faltered over the Soviet Union, the mood of the times gradually shifted to embrace the counterculture. Sandra, living and working amidst the swirl of Melbourne's arts and political scenes, absorbed ideas about women, family, and Jewish culture that often led to tense conversations with her father. My Father's Shadow is a portrait of life on the left, during a time of great social change. Lyrical, sharply observed, and affecting, it is a candid exploration of the fraught dynamics between father and daughter, and, ultimately, the love that underlies them. Sandra Goldblum-Zorbo was interviewed by Jamie Button, a frequent guest and host at Readings events, and the author of three books, Speechless, A Year in My Father's Business, Comeback, and, as previously featured on the Readings podcast with Om Dungel, From Bhutan to Blacktown. Button has won three Walkley Awards and a Melbourne Press Club Quill Award. Here's Jamie Button and Sandra Goldblum-Zorbo.
Great to see so many familiar faces here tonight. I've known Sandra a long time, but I've only known her well in recent years. And it was only last year that I read her book, The Book of Rachel, which was published about 20 years ago. And I was really struck by this book. It's a novel based to some significant degree on life experience of a mother grappling with the heroin addiction of a daughter. And what struck me about that book was the willingness of the writer to look with unflinching honesty at her own role in the situation. And this came up for me as well when I read Sandra's new book, My Father's Shadow. This is a really engaging book. It's a book about a father's relationship with a daughter. It's also a book about the politics of our time of the last 100 years, what the American writer Vivian Gornick called the romance of communism. It's also a book about secrets and loyalty and betrayal and those conditions in life and in writing. And that's what made me think of your earlier book, Sandra. And so I'm going to start by asking you, who was Sam Goldblum and what kind of father was he? Let's start at the beginning.
I was already a writer by the time I started to write the first story, which became close to the last story, the Dying Night story. Or maybe the one about lunch, I can't remember. But one of those two stories, well into the book they became. And they were just going to be short stories that I thought that I would submit. And in a way, that's also what happened with The Book of Rachel. I started with a story that I thought would be the end. So I was working backwards. I was in New York, and by the time I came back to Melbourne, I realised that I wasn't going to get off the hook with a couple of short stories, that this was going to be a novel, and I gasped and gulped, and I kept going. Of the 30,000 words that I wrote, which was three chapters, I kept three words, and the story just developed and developed. And in a way, a similar thing happened with Shadow. I started to write a story, and then I had another story, and then I had another story. But I didn't want to turn Shadow into a novel. I wanted to write a story about my relationship with Dad and about memory, which is not linear like a novel. I didn't want it to be linear because I don't think memory is like that. And as you know from reading the book and others and people who will read it, he was a huge figure and influence in my life, for better and for worse. And I desperately sought his approval certainly at least up until the time I was maybe 40, maybe even a bit beyond that. And the stories kept coming. But there was also periods when I couldn't write. Stuck. And so I'd just go about my life. And then one day something had happened. And things got so bad at one point, I used to see a Jungian therapist who was very good with people who had a creative bent. And so I went to see him and I said, I'm stuck, I don't know what to do. This is very nutshell, you don't want to hear a whole of my therapy sessions, but basically what he said was, well, when you get stuck like that, when you're writing, it means it's something that's very difficult to write and you can't spit it out, write it, whatever. It took a long time to spit, but eventually it came and I wrote a book, which I hope, for all my criticism, there are many criticisms in the book about Dad, but there's also a lot of love. I loved my dad.
Let's just stay on this thing about the Jungian therapist for a moment. Was there something particular in the book that you were struggling to get out?
Yes, yeah. Disloyalty.
Well, keep going. What do you mean?
The more well-known Dad became, the more secretive we had to be. We knew that he was a covert member of the Communist Party, as were many people, but it was the Cold War, and his main reason for keeping that secret was because, and the people in the party thought this was the thing to do, the right way to proceed, was because in those days, communism was such, you know, Reds under the bed and all of that kind of horror. People were raised up to believe. But what he wanted to see was the broadest possible peace movement that took in as many people as possible. No nukes, no war. And it was believed that in order to do that, it shouldn't be revealed that he was a member of the party. Some people knew that he was. Many people believed that he was but didn't really know. And one of the things I found quite extraordinary, like already more than 20 years after he died, when I moved to Castlemaine, and a woman who I used to know from Melbourne took me under her wing a bit, and we'd go to the market on Saturday mornings and she'd introduce me by my full name and people would say, oh, you're the daughter of that commie, Sam Goldblum. Or, oh, he was the boss of the Communist Party in Australia, wasn't he? And extraordinary things like this. I mean, it's just ludicrous. But that's what people believed and that's why he'd never told.
But did everybody know?
I think even people who worked with him in the peace movement, a lot of people presumed and didn't care because he did a job.
Because you and I know lots of people who are in the Communist Party and were open about it.
Absolutely. Mm. Yes, we did. I mean, we knew lots of people like that. Mm. I was open about it, being a member of the party. But for him and his position in the peace movement and being a very, very public figure, it was considered to be a wisdom to not announce this.
And, of course, he was a member of the Labor Party as well.
He was.
And he would have been thrown out of the Labor Party on the spot, I guess, as well.
Well, he would, but he was not the only one. There were plenty of people in the Labor Party who were dual members. They would have been kicked out. Mm. That was also not terribly unusual. Mm. But I think that part of the reason for that was that members of the Communist Party, members of the Trotskyist groups, they wanted to move the Labor Party further left than it was, and so that's where they went to do their work.
But he was a man of other secrets too, wasn't he? There's a really interesting story in the book about the war.
Oh, the war, yes. Yeah,
and
he
said, I was interpreting for Japanese prisoners of war. Mm. And you're thinking, but Dad's language skills were terrible.
They were terrible.
You spoke about three words of Yiddish, right?
And a little bit more than three, but yeah, not much. Yeah.
There were parts of his life when you were growing up that you didn't know about. He had affairs when he went overseas. And
oh, no, we knew about that.
Oh, did you? And it was discussed? Or?
Oh, no, it was never discussed.
Yes.
No, although later on, sisters two and three met the main squeeze in Paris, and I knew about somebody. Well, there's a chapter called Peep, and there's a woman who I knew about, and there were others. He was a philanderer, no sugarcoating on that. I don't say anything that's critical to speak ill of the dead. Mm. That is not the point. I'm not bitter and I love him still. And that's just who he was.
Mm. Well, let's talk about who he was. Let's talk about growing up as his daughter. And tell us about the people who came through your house. There was clearly, I take from the book, a a sense of excitement, as well as a feeling that you had to live up to something for him. There's a great scene at the film festival when, I mean, you should tell the story, but you've just seen Ivan the Terrible.
We just saw Ivan the Terrible Part 2. Everyone goes out for a smoke and an ice cream and a yakety yak, and then the bell goes and it's time to go back inside. And the second film for the afternoon is Kurosawa's Throne of Blood. Oh, Ivey, what a program. You know, death and mayhem and revolution and murder in the forest. And we were doing Macbeth at school, so...
And everyone's leaving.
But everyone's leaving, yes, everyone's leaving. And so a couple who we knew, Yitzhak and Manka, they're leaving, walking out. What's wrong? Oh, we can't stand it, Sam. It's too much. It's too much. But we stayed. We stayed and watched it through. And I guess film for me started with my bubba, my mum's mother. Used to take us to musicals. I can't tell you how many times I saw Brigadoon or Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. She loved them, and she loved Liberace, now that I think of it. So, yeah, I went with him. Mum was ill. That's why I went. And then from then on, I went on my own.
But I was struck out on the pavement. He said, what did you think of the film?
Oh, yes. Well, he used to give me books to read. Mm. Read this. We'll meet on Sunday morning. You bring me a coffee and we'll talk about what you read, Ivey. I've got to make an opinion. Even now, somebody said, what do you think? I don't know, I haven't had time to think about it yet. When we came out, I think it was after the Ivan, and he wanted to know what did I think, and my heart started to flutter and race. Fortunately, somebody came up and got me off the hook and said, good day, Sam, good day, Sandra. So I didn't have to answer, but that was part of my life, was he would give me books by left-wing authors to read, but I had to give an account of my reading on Sunday mornings after I made him a coffee.
We all seek our parents' approval.
Yeah.
Do you think that you were more than seeking his approval because he was somebody that was well known? Let's talk about the people that you were conscious at an early age. You met Paul Robeson, you met Danny Kaye, you met Pete Seeger came to your house. I get the sense that you had some sense of living a kind of public life, to some degree, vicariously through your family. Did that increase your wish to be seen, you know, positively by him, do you think? Or
it was the wallop on the back of the ass. That's what
right,
that's
right.
What made me want to be approved.
Yes, right. He was tough.
He was tough.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And sometimes punitive. Mm. And also, you know, don't be stupid, don't be stupid, don't be stupid. Mm. Well, when someone tells you that often enough, you think you're stupid. So, you know...
When you were with him, was he a present father?
Look, a lot of my life and my sister's lives were very mixed in that respect. Mm. So, for example, my birthday's in June. June is northern summer. That means that everybody in the north, not everybody, but you know, large numbers of people in the northern hemisphere on holidays, so that's when all the peace conferences were held. He was never home for my birthday. He was also very defensive of me. A sister too. She had a teacher, he was known to be anti-Semitic, and his punishment for Jewish kids who talked out in class, you remember the platforms in the old schools, he'd make the kids kneel, both hands on top of their heads like this, and if their toes touched the floor, whack on the back of the legs with a cane. He came up to school and had that teacher sacked. My first real job, I was so excited and I was earning my own money and blah, blah. And after a certain amount of time, not very long, I started to come home and Dad, each day Dad would say, well, how was it? How was it? And I'd always say, terrific, terrific. And then it stopped being so terrific and he wanted to know why, what's going on? No, nothing, nothing. And eventually I told him that the boss was abusing me. And he said, what if I come to work with you tomorrow, Sandy? And I said, no, no, no. He insisted. And we went to work together. The boss at first said, oh, Sandra, this must be your dad. And he put out his hand to shake Dad's hand. And Dad refused to take his hand. And he said, I hear you've been touching up my daughter. And I wanted to die. Anyway, it went backwards and forwards. And eventually Dad said, this is what's going to happen. He said, you're going to pay my daughter 6 weeks severance pay. And if I ever hear anything about you touching up other girls who come to work here, I'm going to come and job you one. Well, even at 17, I knew that there was no way my dad could know that this bloke was going to keep touching up his female staff. But that made him a bit of a hero in that moment, yeah.
Let's do two quick readings, shall we?
All right.
I want you to read, gives us a sense of life as a Goldblum. The Koreans, the North Koreans.
Oh, the North Koreans.
Yeah, let's do that first.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and then we'll read the other one.
Okay, so he rings me up one day. At this stage of my life, I'm working out of the front room of my house in North Carlton, typing for academics or potential academics and authors and playwrights and so on. And he rings me up and he says, the North Korean delegation of two have come and they've got a speech. They want to deliver it to working people of Australia, but it's a bit of a mess. You know, the language is not fantastic and the grammar's not so good. Would you type it up for them? So I said I would do that. And they show up in my front room office and I can't tell from the start whether they speak English or not. There's a whole lot of sign language, come in, you know, sit down and so on. And I had a non-electric typewriter, I think it was, so all you could use to correct errors was an eraser, or if you were a modern woman like me, you could use Tippex. It was a chalky-backed paper and you put it over the error, you type the error, it fills with chalk and then you type the correct letter. Well, they see this and they just about go off their bananas. They're so excited and he takes a little pad out of his pocket and he takes a pen and he's going to do something about this. And so I will just read you this last little bit of this chapter. This time I use the Tippex to demonstrate. I deliberately make an error and fix it. Delighted, both men smile. It is obvious they have understood at once Tippex's magical quality. Please, what name is this? Aha, some English. Comrade One takes a notepad from the inside pocket of his jacket, opens it to a blank page and prepares to write there with a fountain pen. I show him the packet. He and his colleague nod enthusiastically, acknowledging what they have witnessed, the significance of the little packet. By the time Comrade One begins to write, I am also smiling. I reach into the desk drawer and retrieve an unopened Tippex packet. Here, I say, have this one. Take it home. I thrust it in his direction. He raises his eyebrow and puts his hand on his chest. For me, the gesture and eyebrow say? Yes, for you, I nod. He takes the Tippex, expresses his gratitude with a bow and secures the package into the inside pocket of his suit jacket. The men are smiling, talking excitedly. My grin grows broader. Pyongyang typists, look out. Your working lives are about to change. Dad says the speech went well enough, though it was way too long. I wasn't all that interested, really. But I do like to think that in some small way, I am responsible for improving the working lives of the women in the North Korean typing pools because I made a typing error on a day when two men from their country happened into my North Carlton house to have a speech typed up before they delivered it to their great peace-loving friends, the working women and men of Australia, via their representative, Robert J. Hawke.
Gives an example of many of the stories that are in the book. The one I also loved, which we probably don't have time to go into, was Dancing with President Sukarno.
Oh, my grandmother had died and she left £200 to each of her grandchildren. There was still another grandchild to come. And Dad decided that my £200 was going to be spent on some lessons in life, and so he took me to a peace conference in Java, January 1961. So Java and certainly Bali were by no means on the tourist map yet by any stretch of the imagination. And I sort of hung out most of the time. I didn't go to most of the conference. I had somebody who acted as my interpreter and quite possibly my chaperone. And on the closing night, there was a dinner dance and there was a lot of people there, a real lot of people there, including President Sukarno. And Dad and I sort of did this clumping polka around the floor to a live band. And he took me back to our table and he was going to go off and find somebody else to dance with. And then Sukarno's aide-de-camp came up to our table and said to Dad, the president would like to dance with your daughter. So,
to which you don't say no.
Yeah, you don't say no, I guess not. So the aide-de-camp led me over to Sukarno, who danced me around the floor. And he tried to make a conversation, you know, and I'd say, yes, two sisters, yes, still at school, yes, lovely time, thank you. And, you know, what do I have to say to a president? Bupkis, absolutely nothing. So the aide-de-camp took me back to Dad, and that was it. I think it was a waltz with President Sukarno in 1961.
But it's one of the places in the book where you really do a great job. Sandra's very good at setting scenes, and in that case, the writing is really, really vivid about that experience. Let's read a section from page 34, which I talked to you before. In the book, Sandra has grappled in places with the political legacy of her father, his life, his work, his goals, and his position as a communist. And this is one of those parts. So would you read that section for us?
As for Dad, when it comes to the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, and its satellites, he is a fool for love. He will truck no criticism about any of the socialist states. He does not acknowledge the purges or the millions murdered. He will never acknowledge the anti-Semitism, though later, much later, he will describe Gorbachev's perestroika and glasnost as a breath of fresh air. Still, for most of his life, Dad's belief in the Soviet Union, in its form of socialism, remains devout in scope. With the demise of communism, first with the bricks and mortar of the Berlin Wall, subsequently in the other nations of the Warsaw Pact, and finally the Soviet Union, his heart breaks. Here is a domino theory he could never, would never have envisaged.
Yeah, it's a really powerful paragraph. There's more. Tell us about sitting with him. You talk about sitting with him, you're watching the TV, and the news comes on that the Soviet Union is no more. You're actually there at the time, watching the ABC News, and he's in his rocker. It's about 8 years before he dies. And tell us about that scene, because I found that scene really, really powerful.
Well, he was devastated. He said, "What has my life been? All these years believing, wishing, wanting, hoping it would be something else that it could never be." A slight digression, there's a line in the book about somebody said, Tariq Ali perhaps, that the Soviet Union gave socialism a bad name. And I think that's true. He was devastated. I think he went into a blue funk from which he never recovered. It was heartbreaking to watch, really, to sit there with him in those early days when it was all over.
End of the Soviet Union was 1991, so he died in 1999, didn't he?
Yeah. So, yeah. So there's still another 8 years. Mm. Yeah.
But there's a moment there where you actually take his hand and he says, "I don't want to talk about it anymore, Sandy." It feels of a piece with the man in the book who will sometimes just go, "That's it, I'm not going to talk about it anymore."
That's right. Look, I think that's really common of men of his generation. Mm. They don't want to talk about it. Mm. Whatever it is, they don't want to know.
Mm. Do you think he came to that realisation? You know, a lot of his friends in the party and outside left the party in, well, we can go back to the
56.
Yeah, but even Spanish Civil War and people, you know, the reports coming out there of betrayal by the communist leadership of rank and file, and then the purges, 1956, 68, you know, people left in these successive waves. He stayed.
He did.
Why did he stay when people left? And what's your take on his decisions in that time?
I just think he was a loyalist. I think he probably had an extremely difficult upbringing. Mm-hmm. I know that he left home when he was 14, hit the road. His father had died. And I suppose he was looking for nirvana.
Mm. He was religious in that way.
In that way?
Yeah.
Yeah, not in any other way.
He's not a religious man.
No. Mm. Yeah, it was. I say that in the book, where he was devout.
Mm.
Look, to me, it's as if somebody who's been a devout Christian or Jew or any kind or whoever, and they're told, look, and come to realise there's no God.
Mm.
This would be devastating.
Mm. Mm.
And I think that's a reasonable comparison to make about him.
Mm.
He wanted something better.
Mm.
And he thought that that was the way to get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that the Soviet Union would provide it. Even, I was going to say when he knew, but even, I think that he knew. He must have known. You can't not know.
Mm.
I mean, I suppose you can not know, but he was loyal. If he was critical, then it was certainly never within the public sphere.
Was it within the family? Did you hear it?
No, never. Doesn't mean he didn't to others, but I never heard it.
So interesting. on the religious issue, you talk a bit about his perhaps surprising importance of being Jewish, don't you?
It was surprising to me.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, tell us a bit about that, because, you know, he was a religion is the opiate of the masses person. He was a secular atheist communist who never went to synagogue. You know, he said, I only go because your mother makes me go.
Yeah.
But later in life, you discovered that wasn't all to the story.
No, that's what I believed, particularly after Bubba died, because then we stopped doing most of the significant Jewish holidays, except that Mum wanted to keep some of them going so she could have her family around her all together at the one time. Yes, he was an atheist, but in Reform Judaism you don't have to believe in God.
Yeah, sure. But he hadn't expressed interest in the cultural forms either previously.
Well, that's what I thought.
Yes.
But that wasn't so. Mm. And by the time I was 21, I was married and had left home, and I had not particularly taken notice of whatever were the cultural forms that he and Mum were engaged with. At some point in my life, I started thinking about Jewish and about what small amount of it had been in my life and the kids who I grew up with and where I went to school, North Caulfield Central, which was largely, or very large anyway, Jewish population post-war. And I was living in North Fitz, and I found myself going from North Fitz to Elsternwick via St Kilda and North Caulfield and going this street and that street, and she used to live there and she used to live there and that brother and sister. And I was bawling my eyes out. And so one day I rang him and I said, listen, I'd like you to come over and talk to me about what it means to be Jewish to you. I said, come to lunch. And he couldn't wait. And he showed up with a tape recorder, which gave me the shits because I knew it was going to be an interview and it wasn't going to be a conversation.
It's the public man, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And when I told him that I had believed until this moment that being Jewish was not important to him, he was absolutely shocked. He couldn't believe that I believed that. One of the important reasons why I came to realise that I was probably wrong about this belief, I thought about all their friends and what they were all Jewish, all except for one couple. All of their friends were Jewish. The things that they were in, social things they were engaged with, was to do with Jewish community, with the progressive, the left wing, the reform Jewish community. It wasn't the interview. It wasn't the conversation I wanted. It was an interview. It wasn't what I wanted, and I was disappointed in that. But it did make me realise that being a Reformed Jew was important to him. Yeah.
I got the sense in the book that, in a way, you were always in search of your father.
Oh, that's certainly true.
And even after his death, tell people about the files and going to Canberra and finally getting access to his ASIO file and other files. Again, I even though he's gone, you're still looking for clues to a man who remains enigmatic, a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma or whatever.
Yeah, like that thing. Yeah. Well, after he died, I finally decided it was time to go and look at the ASIO files, his, mine. So I made application and I was told it would take up to 90 days. And 12 months later and a couple of phone calls in between, I finally got notice that the files were available. Now, before that, he had received special branch files and they were heavily redacted with black marker. There was hardly anything. There's maybe, you know, a meeting list or somebody married to the wrong person, whatever. I went three times to Canberra and each time I was thoroughly perplexed by his files and my files because I could not understand why they were so dreary. There was almost nothing about his real life. And this was a huge puzzle to me. What I expected to see was black marker through everything, but there was nothing. There was nothing there at all. One of the delights I had, professionally being an editor, was how many errors I found. And because they leave a little box of pencils for researchers on the tables each morning, cross, cross, cross. No, wasn't married to her, married to her, because I felt that at that stage it probably didn't matter. So I had a bit of fun with that. But on the third visit, I'm just sitting there like this, thinking, staring at this page that's on the front of every single buff-coloured file and realising that this page that I thought was National Archive Filing System was something else. And I looked up, what was this something else? And it explained why there was nothing in the files of any use to me or of any revelation of any kind. The redaction was done quite differently. And all these super clean pages in the file, and there was one, I think it was Coburg branch of the party, and they were all redacted with black marker, and I thought, oh yeah, that's her, that's him, that's her husband, that's him. But the, for the rest, there was nothing. The super interesting thing to me was that Sister Two, when she went to have a look at the files, I saw her in a social situation and she told me she'd seen this and she'd seen that and she'd seen something else. I said, they weren't there. She said, yes, they were. No, they weren't. They were. I'll show you. And she scrolls through her phone and there's all this shit that I hadn't seen. And I'm not sure why, but I think because she doesn't use the family name and because she wasn't as politically engaged as I was, that she saw a different set of files. That's the only thing I can conclude from that. That's just surmise, and it just might be, I don't know what you would call that, but yeah.
I just want to make a comment about another character in your book before we go, which is your mum, right?
Yeah.
She's a strong character in the book and we need to talk about her very quickly.
Okay.
There's some very funny moments, right?
Yeah.
You know, one of them when she goes to hospital, it just made me laugh. She says, you know, she thinks it might be terminal and they say, don't worry, Mrs. Goldblum, we don't know what you've got, but we know it's not terminal. And she says, if you don't know what I've got, how do you know it's not terminal? You know? And to your point about loyalty... She is ferociously critical of your father at times, says that's, you know, when you tell her that you're joining the Communist Party, she says, save that bullshit for your father, right? But she's publicly very loyal to him. Yeah.
Completely loyal. Even in front of friends, left-wing Jews used to come on Sunday for afternoon tea and they'd sit around and they'd, you know, argue and discuss and debate and this and that. She would never criticise him until after they'd gone.
Yeah.
What was that bullshit you were telling to so-and-so, that girl about Israel? Rubbish, rubbish. She would really go to town on him. And she was also loyal to her daughters. She was very loyal to her daughters.
You write a lot about his dying in the book, and I wondered whether that was a time when you felt you could show to him that you really did love him very much and that you had an opportunity that sometimes wasn't possible because of his life. To really show...
No, that's a misinterpretation.
Yeah.
Absolutely, I showed him plenty.
Yeah,
and
you?
He showed me.
Yeah, right.
Absolutely. He was really proud of me.
Yes.
He was proud of my sisters. We're all high achievers.
Mm. But there's a real tenderness, though. In that late time, you really do... There's so much kind of connection in that time.
Yeah,
and I thought that's why you might have focused on it so much because it was, you know, such a... It is central to the book, you know, as a period in your lives together. And this takes us out. You wanted to do one last reading before introducing a friend, right?
Yeah.
This is from this time, this section in the book when your father is dying.
I spent around 3 hours singing to Dad in the palliative care hospice until really not another note would come out of my mouth. And one of the songs I sang was this. My favourite Italian song appears on a 12-inch LP of popular Italian songs Mum buys in the 1950s, La Montanara, Song of the Mountains, a stirring melody, but because I remember only the two words of its title, this one I hum. La Montanara is a song loved by partisans fighting the fascists in the mountains where they hide and live. And now, as a treat... To end tonight's doings, I would like to introduce to you my dear friend David Kreiser, who will sing this song to you, La Montanara. And you are welcome to take out your tissues, because it's quite a melancholy song.
Thank you. La super montagna. Fra boschi e val d'or, fra l'aspre rupi e cheggia, un cantico d'amor. Lassù per le montagne, fra boschi e val d'or, fra l'aspre rupi e cheggia, un cantico d'amor. A montanare, hey, si sente cantare. Cantam la montanara et qui non la sang. La montagnara, hey, si sente cantare, cantiamo la montagnara, e che non la sa, là su sui monti, tra le vie d'argento, una campana cospasa di fiore, era la piccola dolce dimore di Soreghina, la figlia del sole, la figlia del sole.
I would like to thank Readings for hosting this event, for all of my friends and relatives and people I don't even know who've come to this event. It's wonderful for me to see old colleagues and comrades and draft resistors and peace workers and others here. It's fantastic. I would very, very much especially like to thank Monash University Publishing, Julia the publisher, Sarah the most wonderful publicist, and Sam. It's been a terrific night for me. I thank you all very much for coming, and I hope that you enjoy the book. Thanks again.
My Father's Shadow is available via all reading stores and at our website. You'll find all kinds of other recommendations for great books, music, film, and TV. You can also sign up to eNews or to receive our free monthly newsletter, The Readings Monthly. The Readings podcast is produced by me, Nick O'Callaghan. The show's music is by Tom Hoskins. The audio for this episode was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'd like to acknowledge traditional owners and pay my earnest respects to elders past, present, and those to come. Thank you for listening.